This week, ties into the last lecture of last term, which was on the Bacon's Rebellion, King Philip's War. Today we're talking about the Glorious Revolution, and I've sort of tacked on a few slides at the end about Salem, sort of in preparation for next week's film. So, and they sort of tie in chronologically quite nicely. So, today, 1680, is the Glorious Revolution. The Glorious Revolution, it's worth remembering back to our Stuart history, which we probably did at GCSE or some other ancient period of history, about James VII and II, King of England for just 3 years, brother of Charles II, second son of Charles I, openly a Catholic, unlike his brother had a deathbed sort of conversion to Catholicism, a bit like Tony Blair, except he wasn't his deathbed. His was a much more overt Catholicism, which of course didn't sit very well with the rest of England, which was Protestant. But he was also, as if being Catholic wasn't bad enough, he was also very close friends with Louis XIV. Louis XIV was, of course, the doyen, the ultimate absolutist monarch. So he wasn't a firm favourite amongst a political class in England that was all about constitutional monarchy, that was all about the limited power of the monarchy, not the absolute power of the monarchy. And of course, he was a Protestant political elite. People could live with James II, providing his heir was his daughter Mary, who was a Protestant. The problem was is that James II's new wife, much younger wife, gave birth to a son in 1688, which to the political classes in England signalled a new line of Catholic kings, the presumption being that this child would be brought to be a Catholic. And so, a lot of leading lords and earls and dukes of so-and-so get together in Parliament and they decide to offer, to invite William of Orange, who just happens to be the husband of Mary, to invade and to basically conquer England. James doesn't wait for them to invade, he runs away. He flees to France, actually. And so William, although he does land with an invasion army, he doesn't need to fight. He sort of takes it by default. He's sort of welcomed. And he and his wife become, for the only time in English history, joint monarchs. And he willingly signs a Bill of Rights, still enshrined as part of English law. Which basically says England is going to be a constitutional monarchy. It's going to be a government of Parliament and the King, rather than just the King. James II didn't give up entirely. He did try and reclaim his throne. He invaded Ireland in 1690, but was defeated by Prince William at the Battle of the Boyne, which of course is the famous battle celebrated by Protestants, Unionists in Northern Ireland. And William, the fact that he's William Orange is why Ulster Protestants are often known as Orange Men. And this is a picture of William and Mary. Mary dies in 1694 and William rules on his own for 10 years. William is basically far more interested in getting British military power involved in the wars against France, of which he is the leading European architect of opposition to Louis XIV. And he's really not that fussed at all about internal British politics, which of course suits all those British politicians who invited him to become king. They've got a king who actually doesn't care what goes on in England, only so long as England provides guns, men, ships, in order to fight Louis XIV. the Rosh Revolution in America has some similarities, but also key differences between that in England. For one thing, the Grand Revolution is only sporadic. It doesn't occur in lots of different places. What we're going to talk about is Massachusetts, New York, Maryland, and South Carolina. So places like Virginia, Pennsylvania, Georgia, you know, well, Georgia isn't a colony then, but there's lots of parts of America where the Georgian Revolution just sort of passes it by without anything happening. So it's a patchy revolution. But the people who live in America do share key traits with their English brethren back home. For one thing, they generally don't like James II, mainly because of his Catholicism. They're also very anti-French. And of course, the French are a power in Canada. And that's one of the reasons why James II and his association with the French is not a good thing for him in America. But also this absolutist tendencies, which they think he has, which he's learning from Louis XIV, is something very antithetical to the American democratic systems. So those are sort of unifying, overarching causes, but there are also some very specific causes, which I'll go through one by one. First of all, Massachusetts. Massachusetts had tried, people in Britain had tried to bring Massachusetts much more into an imperial fold after the restoration of Charles II in 1660. And they'd done this by, for example, implementing the Navigation Acts. The Navigation Acts are a set of acts which dictate how you can trade within the British Empire. And they basically says that all trade within the Empire has to be done, firstly, with Britain, and secondly, has to be done on British ships. Which is meant to make sure that the colonies can't trade independently, for example, to Dutch or French colonies or Holland or France, or use third-party shipping. The thing is, the Navigation Acts are generally ignored. There's a lot of smuggling goes on. There's a lot of blind eyes being turned. Eventually, in 1684, this is even before James II becomes king, the Charter of Massachusetts is revoked. And 2 years later, a new entity, a new colonial entity, known as the Dominion of New England, is created, which basically lumps together all the New England colonies into one big group called the Dominion of New England. So Connecticut, New Haven, Plymouth, all lumped together as this one unit. And the man appointed to rule them is this man here, Edmund Andros, who is a very, very much a favourite of James II. And under the Dominion of New England, there's no provision for an elected assembly, which of course is completely antithetical to how Massachusetts had been governed before. And that roughly shows you the geographic extent of the Dominion of New England, encompassing all those separate colonies. One of the first things that Andros does, and it's always an unpopular move, regardless of time, space, century, government, is increase taxes. Which, of course, the people in Massachusetts are able to portray as taxation without representation, which it is, because there is no elected assembly in Boston. And then, you know, raising taxes basically upsets everybody. But then he does two things which upset specific groupings. He appropriates Puritan churches for the Church of England, which of course upsets the Puritan hierarchy, the Puritan majority in New England. He then tries to clamp down on abuses of the Navigation Acts, which of course upsets all the merchant classes. And finally, he abuses power structures by appointing his friends, his cronies, to significant positions within the Dominion. He has this sort of air of the absolutist monarch, which he, you know, he's taking his cue from James II, Louis XIV. This idea that either you are subjects or you are rebels, and of course, if you're a rebel, then you a very short, sharp drop to the end of the noose. And more than anywhere else in America, the people of New England are very much frightened of French invasion from Canada. And even if the French themselves aren't coming to Canada, they fear that the French are agitating the local Indians to come and attack outlying New England settlements, perhaps in Maine or New Hampshire, somewhere like that. And so all this ties back into this fear of the French, the fear of absolutism, the fear of James II and his association with Louis XIV. These are all very strong suspicions in New England. And when Indians actually do start to attack some of these settlements in New England, then that's seen as proof that James II and Andros and Louis XIV have this plot going to destroy the independence of New England. Andros, to meet this threat of the Indians, starts to send troops north to defend these forts. But this, people in Boston say, leaves Boston defenceless. What happens if a French fleet arrives to take Boston? And the very first sort of action in the Glorious Revolution is a mutiny of troops at Saco River in April of 1689. And it's swiftly followed by a much more widespread popular uprising against Andros. But it's led by the elite. It's led by the Puritans and the merchants, the people who Andros had spent the last two or three months upsetting by taking away their power and their privileges, by ruling without their consent. And the fact that it's led by the elite makes it much more of a genteel revolution and less of a, mob violence, let's butcher whoever we can find type revolution. And Andros quickly finds that he has absolutely no support in the colony. Nobody's willing to come to his aid. And he eventually flees to the city fort. That's the only place where he feels safe. And they publish a declaration stating why they have rebelled against Andros' authority. And they particularly point about their own security situation. That's what they're most worried about, the security of the place. The fact that he hasn't sufficiently secured their borders, provided for their defence against invaders. And the fact that people like Waite Winthrop sign it says a lot. Winthrop, of course, a descendant of John Winthrop, who founded the colony in the 1630s. In the aftermath, the people of Massachusetts established a Council of Safety. This is before so-called Councils of Safety had a bad name, because the Revolutionary Council of Safety in the French Revolution that leads to the Terror, the Jacobin Terror. But this is before they had that sort of bad reputation. The Council of Safety basically governs Massachusetts in the absence of any other legal authority. And they negotiate with William III for the return of the New England charters, which are returned in 1691, 2 years later. But Massachusetts now, instead of being a charter colony, becomes a royal colony, which means that there's a new governor, a man called Sir William Phipps, and he's a merchant. He's the first non-Puritan to be governor. And in fact, his colonial council, which functions as his advisory body, are mainly populated by merchants and not by Puritans. You also get the official establishment of religious toleration in Massachusetts, and the franchise is no longer going to be based on church membership, which of course had been the distinguishing feature of Massachusetts for so long. It's now going to be based on a property qualification, which is exactly the same as it was in England and elsewhere in the Americas. So, the Glorious Revolution is to some extent the final nail in the coffin of the Puritan experiment. Puritans no longer dominate Massachusetts politically, though they continue to be religiously in the majority, and they certainly influence the character and flavour of the New England settlements quite considerably. And partly their demise of the Puritan control over Massachusetts, is because Massachusetts was no longer the society it had been in the 1630s. It had evolved. There had been lots more people coming into Massachusetts. Its society had changed. It'd become more commercialized, more liberalized. And this, in a way, is the inevitable consequence of it. And the Puritans are, in effect, the big losers from the Glorious Revolution, because it does pretty much kick them out of power for good. Secondly, New York. Remember, New York has started as a Dutch colony. It's conquered by the English in 1664. There's various tos and fros between the English and the Dutch over the following 10 years. But finally, in the mid 1670s, the Dutch fully relinquish the control of New York. But they are still very strong. They make up easily the majority of the population, even if they are slightly in decline against the face of English immigration. Our old friend Edmund Andros is appointed governor of New York in 1677. This is quite a long time before he becomes governor of the Dominion of New England. And he does things which are almost designed to wind up the Dutch. You know, he implements an oath of allegiance to Great Britain, and he excludes the Dutch from official positions by appointing English people. And so there's this gradual supplanting of the Dutch society, Dutch language, Dutch culture, with English society, which isn't surprising, I guess, but it's understandable the Dutch resented. But he has this desire to raise taxes. He thinks taxes mean that he has more money to spend on things he wants to spend. As also, like in New England, that you want no representative assembly in New York. So you've got taxes without representation. When the Dominion of New England is created in 1686, New York is sort of subsumed as part of New England. And even nowadays, I don't think New Yorkers would think of themselves as part of New England. But instead of being majority in a small colony, the Dutch are now a very small minority in a much larger political entity. So any voice, lingering voice, they still had in the control of New York is all but disappeared once they're subsumed into the Dominion of New England. Of course, Andros leaves New York for Boston once he becomes governor of the Dominion of New England. That's seen as the capital, much more so than New York is. And when Andros basically loses power in 1689, it encourages the Dutch who are left in New York to rise up again against him as well. And it's led by a merchant, a man called Jacob Leisler. It's often known as Leisler's Rebellion. You might come across it described like that in the history books. A merchant who, of course, had been excluded from office, from power, by Andros. For 2 years, he rules New York, between 1689 and 1691. He does profess a loyalty to James II, William III, of course, because he's Dutch, and William III is Dutch. So you wouldn't have thought there'd be a conflict of interest there. But what he doesn't do is surrender his political authority to English officials in 1691. That's his fatal mistake, effectively. And so the English have to send military forces in to crush Leisler, and he's actually hanged for treason. And there are increasingly harsh reprisals against the Dutch, because there's no way that you can say, resisting royal authority is acceptable. You have to squash it. And so, just as in the Dominion of New England, where the decline of Puritan culture is accelerated and confirmed by the Glorious Revolution, so the decline of Dutch culture is confirmed and accelerated by the Glorious Revolution. Thirdly, Maryland. Maryland, you might remember, is the only Catholic colony. It's got a Catholic proprietor. It allows Catholics to hold office. In every other colony, they're excluded from office. Lord Baltimore is an incredibly powerful man. He is the proprietor. He's effectively the prince. He owns Maryland, except the bits that he gives away or deeds to other people. So he is much more like an absolutist monarch than a sort of feudal landlord. The problem for Baltimore comes is mainly economic. It's not ethnic. It's not not even religious. It's mainly economic. But the assembly in Maryland, which, because Maryland has a sizable Protestant population, the elected assembly is generally Protestant, blames all the economic woes on the Catholic appointees of Lord Baltimore. They're running the colony badly. That's why we haven't got the growth, the prices for our goods that we want. They issue statements such as this: the priests and the Jesuits are living in great splendor, whilst the Protestants live in poverty. So they're making a religious statement, but basically for economic reasons. And like other Catholic rulers, Baltimore is seen to be, you know, arbitrary. He's not seen to be democratic. And this is one of the big themes of the Glorious Revolution in America: this willingness to take action against those who are perceived as arbitrary rulers, and who, in a way, keep power for themselves and don't allow others to rise up through the ranks. This is, in a way, a reflection of the lack of social mobility here in Maryland, just as it was in New England when Andros appointed all his cronies to high office. It's the people who were then excluded from office who, you know, are often the leaders of the rebellion. So it's this Protestant group in the assembly that lead the rebellion against Lord Baltimore, the associators. They do wait, they hedge their bets, they wait until James II had fled before deciding to overthrow Baltimore. And they say that the government of Maryland is politically construed to admit papists. So, of all the colonies that rebel against James II, in a way these ones do the best. These are loyal Protestants. They get the formal support of Britain. They manage their colony well. In 1691, the Anglican Church is established in Maryland, so effectively the Catholic exclusivity ends. You even get a universal tobacco levy to support the Anglican Church. And like every other colony, Catholics are now, after 1691, excluded from public office in Maryland. Though, unlike in some other colonies, there is at least some evidence that various Catholics in Maryland continue to hold office after 1691. I don't think it was particularly enforced strictly. But they did move the colonial capital from a place called St. Mary's, which then sort of disappeared in the fields and was recently rediscovered as an archaeological marvel, I guess, to a place called Annapolis, which still exists. In 1692, Maryland, like Massachusetts, like lots of other places, becomes a royal colony. But unlike many of those colonies, which once they become royal colony, remember Virginia became a royal colony in 1624, Maryland actually returns to being a proprietary colony in 1715. Mainly because the Baltimore family had now become Anglicans and they were no longer Catholics. So, effectively, what you've got in Maryland is this sort of supplanting of one political elite with another. You've got the Protestant political elite taking over from a Catholic political elite and doing so quite successfully. Fourthly, South Carolina. South Carolina is mainly conflict between the proprietors on the one hand, who are mainly in England, and a group of men called the Goose Creek Men. Goose Creek Men, named because they live on Goose Creek, about 20 miles inland from Charleston, they are mainly from Barbados, and they, in the 1690s, are the largest single social group in South Carolina. They make up about half the population. They are experienced settlers. These are not green, newly arrived people from England. These people have been in Barbados for a period of time. They're tough. They know how to live and experience the new world. They know how to get on with it, the business of colonization. And they are very sure that this requires slaves, whether African or Indian. And this is you know, the sort of life they want to create in South Carolina. And as the most experienced settlers, the ones who have been in the New World for a long time, they think they should be the ones who are running South Carolina, you know, on the ground. Not the proprietors, not the people who the proprietors sent over, the people on the ground. The proprietors, of course, don't agree. They think, we've invested all this money in South Carolina, we want to see a return on our money, therefore we desperately need our man, our governor, in charge of South Carolina, dictating policy. It's a contemporary map of what South Carolina was like. Blown up a bit. Charleston is here. In order to dilute, I guess, the power of the Goose Creek men, the proprietors embarked on an immigration program to encourage new settlers, especially religious dissidents from England and from France, Huguenots, etc. And this, of course, has an impact on the Goose Creek men, who were mainly Anglicans. You know, their power, their majority in the colony is being diluted. And indeed, the very first governor of South Carolina is a dissenter. So they are, in a way, being supplanted by these new migrants into South Carolina. And their new governor starts to do things like regulate Indian slavery, outlaw piracy, which is, you know, very unfair, really, because the Goose Creek men were making potloads of money by stealing stuff from the French and the Spanish. And by trying to clamp down on all those activities, they're alienating the Goose Creek men all the time. So, it was all about sort of economics and politics that led the Goose Creek men to basically overthrow the government of South Carolina. They're led by a man called Seth Subtle, who you don't want to say when you've had a few pints of beer. He's actually one of the proprietors. He's one of the very few proprietors to actually go to Carolina. He'd been appointed as the governor of Albemarle, which is now in North Carolina. But on his way to North Carolina, had been seized by Algerian pirates and spent 5 years in an Algerian jail. But eventually he becomes free and gets to go to North Carolina. And for 7 years he rules Albemarle, but the other proprietors force him to resign his position in 1690. And so you've got a former leader who's discontented, and a whole load of settlers who were also discontented, and of course the two find common cause very quickly. And he helps to lead the rebellion against the established Governor Colleton in 1690, and changes the government of South Carolina fairly radically. But this only lasts about a year, and Southall himself is eventually replaced, and there is a new government of South Carolina, and eventually the Goose Creek men can't stop renewed immigration from England, which changes the character of South Carolina away from the sort of hue that they wanted it to be. And so it's a fairly short-lived hiccup, I guess, in South Carolina history. Shares a lot of the same concerns about Catholicism, about absolutism, but it's much more about local power in South Carolina. It's not this sort of worried about the French, worried about Louis XIV sort of thing. It's, you know, we want our own power, we want to run our own colony. So, you've got your idiosyncrasies in the Gorge Revolution. You've got Puritans, the Dutch, the Catholics, the Barbadians. They all have different motivations for taking advantage of James II's overthrow. But there is a common factor, I think, is to look at this idea about generational settlements. If you look at the sort of dates of foundation of these colonies, they're all roughly similar. New York, 1626, Massachusetts, 1630, Maryland, 1634. The Barbadians settled in Carolina in the 1670s, though Barbados itself was settled as a colony in the 1620s. So they've all got this about 50-year history in the New World, and This, I think, is really important because it links then back to Bacon's Rebellion in Virginia, which is 15 years previously, but of course Virginia was founded 15, 20 years previously to the 1620s. It's the idea that you've got settlers who've been there two or three generations. Do they continue to hold power, or do new settlers come in and supplant and overthrow them? Who is going to be the ones in control? It's these tensions that caused the Glorious Revolution in America, I think. Well, there's a bit there about the various different colonies which are founded after 1692. I mean, they're listed there, but actually, we'll come back to that in a later lecture. The issue, interesting thing about 1692, though, which is here, is that although you've got all these new royal colonies and royal governors, and you think that, well, the Puritans have lost power, surely the English are going to have much more control over what's happening in Massachusetts. The issue is really that the king isn't that interested in America. William III isn't that interested. Queen Anne isn't that interested. George I and George II are that interested. They're much more interested in Europe. British government follows really what the king's doing. And so for the next sort of 60 or 70 years, the Americans are left to get on with it. Left to govern themselves effectively. And it's when that dynamic changes, or is tried to be changed, in the 1760s where, you know, real problems occur. Right, let's run through some issues about Salem. The Salem witchcraft hysteria starts in the winter of 1691-2. So we're talking about the immediate aftermath of the Glorious Revolution here. Salem Village, which is just north of Boston. And you've got these young girls, teenage girls, basically being silly. They are, amongst other things, trying to predict who they're going to marry. And they're doing this by dabbling in what you might call witchcraft. One of these groups, and there are several, is based at the house of this man, Reverend Samuel Parris, who is the minister in Salem Village. And when the girls begin having exhibiting strange behaviour, then Parris calls in the village doctor to examine these children. But the doctor can't find anything wrong with them. There's no physical illness that they have. But they clearly have symptoms, you know, speaking in tongues, having fits, all these sorts of things. And so it's the doctor, William Griggs, who diagnoses the influence of the evil hand, which is another way of saying witchcraft, is making these girls sick. And so the girls are immediately questioned by Parris and others, and they name Tituba, a West Indian slave woman who belonged to Parris, a woman called Sarah Good, and another Sarah Osborne, neither of which were popular figures in Salem, as the ones responsible. These three women are questioned, and whenever these women are brought in near the girls again fall into fits, they start acting strangely, and Tituba eventually confesses that she does still practice voodoo, but that's quite common on West Indian islands. And authorities quickly become convinced that witchcraft is rife. They actually take the girls round the village, and wherever the girls start having fits, they arrest the people who live there. And they, within about 6 months, more than 100 people have been arrested in Salem. And they establish a special court to try the cases of witchcraft. And they accept physical and so-called spectral evidence. And the exception of the acceptance of spectral evidence is very irregular. It's certainly not common in New England witchcraft trials, but it is accepted here. And these pictures show you, here is a woman being examined for physical marks those who are in league with the devil are believed to have a third nipple, which suckle the devil with. Basically, any mole you have on your body could be accepted as a third nipple. It's not a particularly rigorous test. But they would strip the woman and she would be examined in the courtroom to see if she was a witch. But also, you'd have here, you know, children or fainting or people fainting, and the children would say in court that they could see the devil aiding the accused. Let's say, you know, I can see the devil. He's sitting on her shoulder. He's whispering. He's telling her what to do. You know, and then the child would collapse and fits again. And then they would say, you know, now he's going to make her fly around the room. I can see her flying. Her spirit's flying. She's standing there, but she's really flying around the room. She's pricking me. She's poking me. She's hurting me. Stop it, stop it, stop it. They're very, very dramatic affairs. But the acceptance of this sort of spectral evidence, which the judges themselves can't see, is not normal. This court's willingness to accept these children's word as truthful is crucial, I think. A woman called Bridget Bishop is the first to be tried. She's a very unpopular woman. She's been married 3 times. Remember, you're in a society which is... places a great store on monogamy, you know, stable family household. So the fact that you've been married 3 times suggests that you are not normal. She's duly found guilty and executed at a place that becomes known as Witch's Hill, still known as Witch's Hill in Salem. 18 others were also hanged. Not all women, some men, but mainly women. Those who refused to plead guilty or not guilty to the charges were pressed. Under English law, you couldn't be tried for any crime unless you pled guilty or not guilty. If you refused to plead, you'd be pressed, which means you'd be staked out on the floor and have big stone slabs placed on you until you pled or until you die. At least one man was crushed to death rather than plead to the charges. A few months... You know, this went on for quite a while, a few months. But on October the 3rd, Increase Mather, a famous Puritan minister, a very influential, important person, preached a sermon questioning this spectral evidence, whether the court should really accept it. And he actually was brave enough to say, better that 10 suspected witches escape than one innocent is condemned. And on October the 12th, Governor Phipps, remember him, recently appointed first non-Puritan governor of Massachusetts, halted the trials and the executions, and everyone else who was in jail was either pardoned or exonerated. So you've got an episode here which, you know, is incredibly dramatic, and you know, you can read things like the trials transcripts online, which you might find interesting to do, actually. And there's lots of books written about Salem. One of the most important reasons, the explanations why Salem occurs, is the fact that if you live in a society where belief in God is really, you know, rife, really important, everybody believes in the power of God, then almost by default you have to believe in the power of the devil. You can't believe in the power of one without the power of the other. Otherwise, we know, what's God struggling against if there's no enemy? There's got to be an enemy, and that enemy is Satan. And Satan's sole purpose is to tempt you into sin and wickedness. And the belief is that, you know, you signed the devil's book, which meant you sold your soul to Satan in return for supernatural powers, for special luck, fortune, riches, personal gain, or just to cause trouble and mischief on behalf of Satan, to recruit other people into your witch's coven. And of course, if you're living in a pre-modern society, every unexplained event, which could be things like a sudden illness, a premature death, or a run of amazing luck, could be caused by supernatural interference, or even run of amazing bad luck. If your cow suddenly dropped down dead for no reason, didn't seem ill, just suddenly keeled over and died, then you're much more likely in the 17th century to blame witchcraft than anything else. And of course, People in Salem weren't the only people to believe in witches. Witches are very commonly believed in throughout Europe. Even James VI, otherwise known as James I, King of England, when he was still King of Scotland, published a book called Demonology, which basically said that, you know, witches and witchcraft did exist, and that you had to execute witches because thou shalt not suffer a witch to live, which says so in the Bible. And this is not the only episode of witchcraft in New England, but it's certainly the biggest, and certainly has the most deaths. Usually they're far more isolated. The people accusing or making the accusations of witchcraft were invariably young women in their teens. And about 80% of those accused of being witches were women, often older women, and often of low social status. And some of the accused are midwives, and there is some suggestion that the miracles, quote unquote, that midwives could perform with newborn children, for example, a child that was seeming dead when born could be revived and brought to life by the skills of a midwife, then this sometimes led to accusations of supernatural powers. Demos' book, Entertaining Satan, talks about this generational gap quite a lot, suggesting that it is this youthful rebellion against older women's authority. However, it's also true that the girls, the young women, are generally from older, established families, people who have been in Massachusetts for quite a long time, and the people who are accused are much more likely to be recent immigrants into Massachusetts. So again, you've got that tension between new and old settlers, linking back to the Glorious Revolution. And Salem, anyway, is not a peaceable society where people get along nicely. It's a very fractious society. Town meetings are always divisive. Ministers have come and gone. There's no stabilising influences here. It's really a this sort of tinderbox society where somebody's just waiting for somebody to throw a match in and then it'll go... And you've also then got this social uncertainty caused by the Glorious Revolution. You've got a Puritan state transforming itself into a mercantilist state. And of course that's causing a great deal of social anxiety. And maybe this is just one manifestation of that anxiety. And why is Salem so important, so well remembered? Because it's pretty much the last big witchcraft hysteria, big witchcraft craze in the Western world. Not the last witches ever to be executed, not the last witch trials, but the last big event. And if you go to Salem, they make a really big deal of it. There's, a whole tourist industry based around the Salem witchcraft hysteria. And there's a lot of reading on Salem, which I think you perhaps ought to get into. There's Devil in the Shape of a Woman, Carol Carlson's book. There's Boyer and Nissenbaum's book, Salem Possessed. There's lots and lots and lots of stuff on the reading list, which I think you maybe get into. But this is sort of like a brief summary, so that when you watch the film next week, you'll be able to put it in some kind of context. Because the film is very good at depicting things like the spectral evidence of the girls, and the way the society is very fractious and divided in amongst itself.